If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. Were the Aztecs really obsessed with death and sacrifice? Did they have a pantheon of deities similar to that of the ancient Greeks or Romans? And how did a magical gem change the fortunes of the Aztec people? Speaking to Emily Briffitt, Camilla Townsend draws on her new book, Aztec Myths, to delve into the stories, legends, and folklore to reveal a society bursting with life and colour.
Hi, Camilla. Thank you so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast.
I'm very happy to be here.
We'll be delving into the myths, stories, and legends of the Mexica people. So can you give us a brief introduction to who the Aztecs were and a little bit about their rich mythic tapestry?
Right. That's actually a good question, who the Aztecs were. That is to say, no people ever called themselves the Aztecs. The people who ruled Mexico when Hernando Cortés arrived in 1519 called themselves the Mexica. But many years later, in the 1700s, in fact, they were given that name. They had used the word Aztecs to describe their ancestors, who were supposed to have been people from a mythical place called Aztlan. So when we say Aztec now, most of us are talking about the people who ruled when Hernando Cortés showed up, but they themselves would be a bit confused by that. Their ancestors, those people that they called Azteca, had come down to central Mexico several hundred years earlier. They were the last of an ongoing stream of migrants to be coming down from the southwest of today's United States. They were coming down to the south because they had heard of the great, fertile, beautiful valley that is today's, you know, central valley of Mexico. The Aztecs were, or the Mexica, were the last to arrive, and they were the most powerful, as you know, when Hernando Cortés came.
So your book touches on the Aztec myths. Now, why do the Aztecs have such a rich mythic tapestry?
Well, in a way, there are two answers to that question. There's the rich mythic tapestry that we have heard about many times before, about how they loved to eat human hearts for breakfast and were convinced that the world would end if they didn't do that. This sort of thing has been told over and over again, based largely on writings of the Spaniards and even other Europeans who hadn't been to Mexico in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. On the other hand, what I decided to do was to write a book based entirely on stories that they had written in their own language, which was Nahuatl. Nahuatl is still a living language, but it was more vibrant then. So I decided to focus only on the stories written in their own language of Nahuatl that they preserved purposely in the 1500s for their own posterity. Less work has been done with these sources than you might think, probably because of the language barrier. That is, scholars have to study Nahuatl. There are, as I said, living speakers of Nahuatl, but most of them are farmers or impoverished people who are really not in a position to take the time and energy to study 16th century writings. So this book is unusual in the sense that it is based only on sources in the Nahuatl language that were written down for their own posterity in the 1500s. I have purposely excluded everything that the Spaniards said about their religion, and I'm sure that some of what the Spaniards said was true. But in the meantime, sort of for a while, I would like us to spend time that we haven't spent in the past with these Nahuatl language sources, rather than trusting entirely what the Spaniards said, much of which seems to have been wrong.
Now, how were these tales shared in their own day?
When the Spaniards arrived, the friars were very keen on proselytizing people, and they taught dozens and eventually hundreds of young men, they were young men, not young women, by the way, the Roman or Latin alphabet so that they could study the Bible. And these young men did do that. We have lots of books and writings produced by friars and their indigenous students working together. Very interesting stuff, and many people have studied that. They also took this alphabet home with them, and they said to the elders in their own communities, tell me the history, tell me the stories that you used to tell. In a few cases, they actually went to public performances of the histories, and they transcribed what they heard. So they wrote in their own language what they were hearing, but using the Roman or Latin alphabet. Their own traditional writing had been glyphic, and that is not a way of representing sound. These pictures are illicit memories or illicit memorized speeches, which are lost to us today. But these sources were transcriptions of what they were hearing live, almost like a tape, if you will, of what they were hearing in that moment. I wish we had more of them, but we do have dozens, so they're well worth studying.
Are there any enduring themes throughout these tales? And if so, what can they tell us about the Aztecs?
The enduring themes are actually quite different from the ones that the Spaniards had given us or had told us about. Rather than being obsessed with death, the Aztecs actually mourned death, bemoaned the need for war. The sacrifice victims were prisoners of war. It was an old custom in parts of Mesoamerica to sacrifice an occasional prisoner of war. And they bemoaned the need to do this. The artists and singers in particular literally cried aloud in some of the stories that they told or the songs that they sang about the sadness of the need for this, the sadness of death. They were not convinced that there is an afterlife. They were flirting with that idea. My understanding from colleagues who are classicists is that there was some discussion and debate about that in the ancient Mediterranean world as well. They did think warriors and women who died in childbirth probably lived longer in a sort of a heaven where they took care of the gods, fed the gods. But most people had only this life, and it caused them to have a very interesting and wonderful philosophy that we must live life well. And that doesn't mean living it selfishly, but live it fully and thoroughly and with great appreciation and joy. Live it for others so that they will remember you well. Don't imagine that it is okay to ignore the beauty or okay to behave badly by others, because this is the best time. This that we have on earth is what we should be celebrating and even worshiping in a sense. So very different from the sorts of themes that we'd been given to understand were important by the Spanish language sources.
I think one of the things that reading your book, there seemed to be a lot about endings and beginnings, the start of the world, the start of the human civilization, the start of life, as well as the end of these things. So I wonder if maybe we start with the creation myth almost. How most cultures seem to have one of those. How did the Aztecs think the universe was created?
Right. Well, like most Mesoamericans, they believed, and many still do believe, that there have been many worlds. They believed that they were living under the fifth sun in the fifth world, and prior worlds had been swept away by the divine, by their own vulnerability, and this one eventually would be too. But we are still living in the fifth sun now. At any rate, when the gods drew together actually in a very beautiful and special place that can still be visited, Teotihuacan near Mexico City, one of the most glorious of the ancient ruins. When the gods drew together there in the utter darkness, because there was no sun, they were in the void between worlds, they asked the sort of remaining humans who were drifting in this void, would one of them be brave enough to immolate himself, to set himself on fire and in his own bravery create the sun for others? And a great hero volunteered and said he would do it. And the gods said, okay. They looked around for other volunteers and there were none. So they chose an ordinary mortal who had been hanging back, Nanahuatzin, who actually, his name means pimply-faced one, you know, really ordinary guy, right? And he said, okay, I don't want to do it, but you gods have always been good to me, so I must do my duty by everybody else. Well, and this was very symbolic for the Aztecs. What happened was that the great hero found that he couldn't actually do it. He ran towards the fire, but you know, it's against all human instinct to jump into fire, and he couldn't do it. And the ordinary little guy who had just been told, you must do this, it's your duty, and who had accepted his duty, was able to do it. And so this very ordinary person, their ancestor, figuratively speaking, the Aztecs, ancestor, was able to call forth the strength that he needed to do what was needful for the community. And he jumped into the fire and the sun was born. After that, the great hero copied him and he became the moon. So there's a role for great heroes as well. But it's actually the ordinary person who was born nobody, who may be called upon to suffer and endure and to triumph, even if they don't feel that they have the strength. The Aztecs are saying, you will find the strength. You must find the strength. It's in that way that life and other people's lives will continue. It's, I think, very, very beautiful in the notions that they're subscribing to.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Now, you mentioned there about gods and the almost deities, really. Now, I think many of our listeners will be familiar with the Norse or the ancient Greek or ancient Roman pantheons. Are Aztec deities similar in that way, or are they very different entirely?
You know, that's another great question. We know relatively little about them because there wasn't much discussion encouraged of the old gods after the Spaniards came. Well, there was no discussion encouraged, so there was very little that took place. What European scholars and American scholars, what Euro-descended scholars have wished to believe is that there was a pantheon exactly like that of, say, the Norse or the Greeks. And they have, in effect, made one up. They have listed dozens of gods. You can find these names on the internet. And those names and those principles did exist. But what we find when we look very closely, either at the artwork or at these alphabetic sources, these written sources, is that people had very different views of these gods. And this makes sense, you know. There was no government, There was no, shall I say, strong nation state government, no school, no public schools with books that were being issued, no equivalent of a Bible. So each person had their own view of things. So, for instance, in one lovely drawing of a divine figure that was made after the conquest, some people said, oh, that's Huitzilopochtli, the Aztec's tutelary or protective god. And others said, oh, no, it's Tezcatlipoca, who is in fact sort of like fate. They seem to have understood that there were attributes of divinity, and they kind of clumped them together in different ideas that tended to have to do with, say, rain and water, or with creativity, or with danger. But they could mix and match these traits. So it isn't quite accurate to say there was a god of childbirth and a goddess of, you know, the earth. On the other hand, there are kernels of truth to that. They more often thought of the rain as masculine than feminine, etc. So I do talk about gods in the book. I try to resist saying the gods or giving a list of 12 names or something like that, which you will find in other more traditional books about the Aztecs. Again, those lists came from sources prepared by Spaniards who really wanted to find the equivalent of the 12 Olympians, something like that.
I think in your book, you describe almost three principles instead of gods.
Right. Well, I would say, now again, not all scholars would agree. Many would still list the names of many separate gods. But I find that there are descriptions that tend to fall in one of three camps. That is, there are gods or divine figures, beings that have to do with water and earth, streams, rivers, fertility. Again, those can mix and match rather easily. There are other descriptors or aspects of the divine that seem to have to do with creativity, the creation, the birth of humans, and sometimes the death, the creation of all humans, the roles of priests. The wind is part of this because it has to do with, you know, movement and creating new situations. And then there are descriptors or divine attributes that seem to have to do more with the dangers of life and the universe, fate, which can be both kind and cruel. It can reward you for good behavior, but sometimes punish you for crimes that weren't even yours because life is like that. Life is dangerous. So if we try to say there was, you know, a god of rain, I mean, what people will come up with is Tlaloc. That's close, but the figure of Tlaloc seems to have contained hundreds of other beings and entities. Every stream was Tlaloc, but it was also something subservient to Tlaloc. They had complex religious or spiritual ideas, and as I said, they varied from individual to individual as they interpreted what they had heard without any standard textbooks. So it's complicated, but certainly there were principles of earthiness and water and life like that. There are principles of creativity, making things, artists as well as priests, I should have said, were part of that. And then the principles of danger and change and movement. Okay.
There seems to be some recurring names. Now, I know what we've spoken about is it's quite hard to define and pin down characters to themes, but there does seem to be some that do keep cropping up. I wonder if you could touch on some of these.
So the Aztecs' tutelary god, their protective figure, was a very definite being, Huitzilopochtli. It means, in effect, left-footed like a hummingbird, or possibly hummingbird on the left, but more likely the first. He, and it was a he, is sometimes called sort of the god of war, but that's really not right. He was their god, their being who had been with them for centuries and wandered with them as long as they carried the bundle of his sacred attributes with them and looked out for them. And he figures in the stories of their early lives, which are a little bit historical, you know, loosely based on some historical realities, but mostly are simply figurative, mythic stories. And some of them are really quite fascinating. There is this figure, Tlaloc, who was, again, the god of rain, wateriness on earth, etc. They certainly prayed to a being called Tlaloc or the multiple beings, Tlaloque, beings that were part of Tlaloc when there was drought, for instance. There was a female being, Kilastli, that they often called on when a woman was giving birth, but there were other figures they called on when a woman was giving birth, too. I don't want to say that there was one goddess of childbirth, but so there were figures who had a certain place in their world, and they're as close as we're going to get to the notion of an Olympian god.
How did the Aztecs communicate with and worship these divine beings?
So their ideas of worship were very complex because they were what we might call pantheistic. That is, there's divinity everywhere in these different attributes, as I've talked about. They believed that they were walking through, living in a divine universe. But they also fully recognized that we ordinary humans don't perceive it that way all the time. So they were very attuned to moments when that divinity, that magic, that specialness of the universe comes through to us. They found it in great beauty, like mica or other bits of shining stone, or extraordinary feathers from tropical birds, rainbows, cloud formations. We too have experienced that, you know, in modern times where we suddenly feel that we're close to God or the gods. So they felt that they were all close all the time and looking for ways to experience this On the other hand, they also wanted to trust what today we would call ritual specialists, that is, certain kinds of priests or certain kinds of diviners to help them figure out what to do. Although, like most people, they perhaps believed in the surface of their mind on one level, so to speak, that this was the case, and on another level were quite practical. So, for instance, you would have a diviner come to tell you, to help you name your child, but you wouldn't want to simply name the kid for a day sign like Malinali, a certain kind of grass, that was going to bring bad luck, that was a sign of bad luck. So the diviner would help you decide that your child had really been born before midnight or after midnight and really was on another day. So on one hand, they were fully trusting these ritual specialists to help them determine the course of their lives. But on another level, the role of the ritual specialist was to work with them to make it possible for them to do what they really wanted to do. And I think that, too, is familiar in modern times. Many people go to church and are profoundly religious, and maybe that religion tells them not to use birth control, but then they do, and they work it out, right? So the Aztecs were, too. I wouldn't want to create the sense that these were people who didn't dare move without a priest telling them exactly what to do. It really wasn't like that.
I'm intrigued about this idea of talking about birth and the start of life. Now, were there any other traditions or stories surrounding that?
Oh, yes. The stories surrounding birth are really quite wonderful, I think, from our point of view, since we come from such different traditions. I mean, as you know, we women are supposed to suffer in childbirth because of Eve's sins. This goes on and on forever, apparently. But the Aztecs believed that a woman was going out into the universe to help seize a soul or an animate being for her people, for the future of her people, in the same way, actually, that a warrior might go forth and take a prisoner of war who then became a captive and became part of his own people's culture. It was considered very brave, and all the prayers and exhortations to the young women giving birth were like, you can do this, you're carrying the shield, you're carrying the sword, go out there, find the strength, do it, honey, and how proud we are of you and how much we love you for being so brave. None of this, you can suffer through it, you know, this punishment will end in a little while, nothing like that. And it, I think, was very heartening and very inspiring of pride. If a young woman did die, she became just as great a hero or, you know, a heroine as her brother who died in war. So it was, I think, on a very profound level, a very moving experience for the whole community.
Were there other important stages in life that were shrouded with this sense of mythos, tradition, and legend?
Yes, there were. Because they valued their community and the people writ large so much, it actually was very important to them to mark young people's stages of life as they became part of those communities in different ways. So, for instance, when they grew up and it was time to marry, there were long ceremonies in which both the young groom and the young bride heard exhortations about what they must do. Young men, for instance, you know, were allowed to sleep with other women, but they were not allowed to be profligate or leave a young woman unsupported. Young women had to prepare themselves, for instance, in their new married life to go without sleep because they were going to have to get up very early and get the water. And then the babies were going to come and they were going to have to get up and feed the babies. And so they must sort of learn to accept that this was their fate and, you know, find the love and the energy to move forward with this. So over and over again, they were told what they must do so that they wouldn't shame their people and how in these ordinary matters, they could also make their people very proud. So the idea of kind of a communal celebration and talking, singing, chanting aloud, giving speeches aloud about these events was very important to them. Funerals also, of course, were a major event, and there were a lot of them because it was a time of many wars. Because they did not believe necessarily that there was an afterlife, I mean, warriors, they thought, maybe did go for a few more years to live with the gods, but even they would eventually disappear. They called the land of the dead, our place of disappearing together. They moaned aloud, cried aloud in a way that I think modern psychiatrists would say was quite good for them. Like, oh, whoa, we will never see this person again. Oh, gods, how can you do this to us? Expect us as mortals to survive these losses. What will we do? Will we ever see them again? No, we will not. So sort of in an agonized, loud and community-wide sort of venting of grief, they acknowledged that that was a terrible loss that could not be made up. There was no telling of young people what they should believe, what they must believe, that they must believe that it's all going to be okay later, and that they shouldn't mind it now because later they're going to see them again in heaven, and stop crying because it'll be okay later when you see them again. None of that. It was much more true to feelings. And then, as part of it, they also promised to remember that person forever and ever. And so that also, I think, made them feel better about the loss. If it were a child, a young person, an old person, they would remember. So that person would not really have disappeared. And there again is something, I think psychiatrists would say, quite helpful about this, but also quite beautiful when we think about it, and very different from most of our modern religious reactions to death. I guess I should say, perhaps the major religions of Europe. I don't pretend to know what all the religious traditions around the world do in times of death.
I think that's a really interesting point to make. If we go from the sort of the end of one thing to almost the beginning of another thing, because as we've sort of been speaking about, there's lots about the lifespan of things. Could we maybe talk about what they believed about the beginnings of human society? What was the legend surrounding that?
Yes, it really quite fascinating to me. The stories were almost entirely about learning to work together and experiencing great rage and crisis that breaks groups of people apart. So, you know, the perennial human story, attempts to form alliances and larger groups punctuated by these sort of horrible quarrels. And they were interested in, I think, telling these stories as a way of helping people deal with current quarrels and crises that they might be experiencing. Again, they were quite realistic about them. They were not trying to tell people just don't fight, don't have crises. I think they knew that that wasn't going to work. It was more about crises and arguments and fights and wars that had happened in the past and what had been done about them and how to move forward. One story that I find very interesting has to do with men and women, and it has been interpreted as a misogynist story in the past, but I really don't think it is. There are various versions, but essentially Huitzilopochtli, their tutelary god, has a huge quarrel with his sister. She had actually tried to kill their mother because their mother was going to give birth to a different baby, a new baby who was going to take her place. This daughter was the mother of the heirs, the most important child. And this new baby was going to take her place. And so she thought, well, the answer to that is to kill the mother. And the new baby that was in the mother's belly was enraged with this by the time he was born. She had not succeeded in killing the mother. And so the baby was born. And he was born as a warrior. And he grabbed his sister and he tore her apart and threw her body parts down onto earth, onto the various the mountain where they were. And they described in great gory detail, you know, one arm went here, one leg went there. And there's a great sculpture of this that was found in the great temple in Tenochtitlan, in today's Mexico City. And this has been interpreted as sort of a vision of a misogynistic divinity. I don't really think it is, because after this happens, the whole world is shocked and horrified. The very birds stop singing and leave the valley because of what he has done to his sister. If anything, I read it as a story about the horrors that ensue when families plot against each other or people struggle against each other and rage is uncontrolled. One's own sister, in one version, it's his actual mother that he tears apart, but can get thrown about. Then there's this horrible sort of shuddering reaction to that the people have to live with forever after. It's not a happy ending for Huitzilopochtli either in that story. So I think they were trying to deal realistically, or perhaps it was unconscious, perhaps I shouldn't say trying. The storytellers were dealing on a very realistic level, a very sort of psychically helpful level with the kind of anger that people feel towards each other sometimes, unfortunately.
I think that's really interesting. There's a couple of other stories that involve their patron god, isn't there? I think talk about this sort of long migration as well of the Aztec peoples.
Yes, they had a story that was quite accurate in some regards, that they had been migrating for generations. That part was true. And in this story, they were carrying the bundle of elements of nature that represented Huitzilopochtli, thus representing Huitzilopochtli. And so he accompanied them. Some would say in some stories, he accompanied them as a sort of priest, a semi-divine priest. In other cases, he's just watching over them as a god. I think their beliefs about that varied. And there are very interesting elements of this. At one point, they stop to rest. They've been traveling with some figurative cousins, some distant relatives that they want to form a community with. And they're under a tree resting, and a great branch of the tree, it's like a branch of the family tree, figuratively speaking, breaks off and falls down. And the representative Huitzilopochtli says, I know what this means. It means we are not supposed to continue to wander with these figurative cousins. We need to break apart. We won't do well together. We have to respect the differences and break apart. And they do. They wander off without them. But this, then of course, forward in time, this creates a situation where they make war against the descendants of the people they have left. So I think the story isn't arguing, oh, this was a great thing that we did, nor are they saying this was definitely wrong. The story is simply showing that this early break had repercussions down the line in time, as it does in human lifespans as well. They're trying to get people to think about what they've done and what the consequences will be and what they have to do now because of the past, more, I think, than they are trying to judge what was right or wrong about that past.
Just a question. Where were they coming from and where were they going to on this migration? It seems to be quite an important story.
Yes. The Aztecs and many other Aztec language-speaking peoples from Mesoamerica all believed that they had come from the far north, and indeed their ancestors really had come from the far north. The Aztecs and a couple of other groups too, in fact, believed that they came from a mythical place called Aztlan. The etymology is a little unclear. I used to be convinced that it was the place of the herons, but grammatically that's actually not quite right. It may have been more like the chalky place, almost like a swampy place. It's unclear. In any event, they represented this place both in picture and in written stories that were coming from oral stories as a place that they had had to leave because the gods, in effect, suggested this to them. In truth, their ancestors had probably left because of a time of drought or warfare, and they had heard stories of the Central Valley of Mexico. But it makes for better storytelling, better poetry, to put it in terms of the divine, right?
While we're talking about this really early history of the Aztec people, could you tell us a little bit about the Chichimecs?
So the Chichimecs, it literally means the savage people whose breasts are bare. Okay, they were understood by the speakers of Nahuatl to have been the people who lived in the north. They would have called themselves Chichimecs at an earlier date when they were wandering down from the mythical Aztlan. They would have understood themselves to be Chichimecs. The people in central Mexico, in the Central Valley of Mexico, who had been farming for a couple of millennia, they were understood to be artisan types of people, often called Tolteca, creative people who built beautiful things. And the Aztecs that were conquered by the Spaniards, the Mexica at that time in the 1500s, understood themselves quite accurately, in fact, to be descended of both groups, the quote-unquote savage wanderers who had intermarried with the longtime farming peoples of central Mexico. It's a bit like Genghis Khan and his Mongols coming down and intermarrying with the Chinese of central China. So they saw themselves as a fusion of peoples who had very civilized credentials, so to speak, and people who were proud warriors, successful warriors, feisty, tough guys. They loved both attributes of themselves and included both attributes in stories about themselves. But interestingly, the storyline more often focuses on the Chichimecs, on the arrow-shooting savage ancestors who had come down from the north. They were the ones that they were most proud to be descended of.
Why do you think that is?
I suppose because the Chichimecs were the successful warriors. At first, the migrant groups coming down from what is today the southwestern United States, from as far north as, say, Utah and down into northern Mexico, they would have been all male groups. You know, war parties don't usually bring women and children. They didn't have horses, so these would have been fast-moving, literally jogging warriors who would appear out of nowhere, conquer new areas. They were more devoted to the bow and arrow than the central Mexicans were, who had been more reliant on the atat, that is, a spear-throwing device. Bows and arrows have the advantage in that you can fire them from distance. Now, other people quickly adopted them, but they had a sort of a mystique as successful warriors. And I suppose that they, because they were winning these battles, then set the tone as stories and songs were shared around firesides. The people they intermarried with, the longtime farmers, although present in the stories and very important in the stories, very important, perhaps weren't the ones creating the structural dynamic, the grammar of the story, so to speak.
Presumably, the Aztecs took note of their own history, as we've spoken about the origins. Throughout the rest of their history, are there other legends and tales that spring up that reveal a little bit more about Aztec culture?
The Aztec stories are very revealing, both about some central elements of their history, maybe not the exact details, but the central dynamics, and about their culture. So, for instance, one very beautiful story is about a princess from Cuernavaca, Miahuashiwit, corn tassel gem or corn tassel flower. The Aztecs at this time were still very ordinary guys. They hadn't yet risen to power. And they send an emissary to the king or the high chief, the Tlatoani of Cuernavaca, asking for his daughter. The Aztecs wanted to marry her. It says quite bluntly in the story, because her people grew lots of cotton, lots of wild cotton. They wanted to be able to trade with her people. And I have no doubt that that was historically accurate. I mean, archaeologists tell us that it was. But the king of Cuernavaca says, I would never let my daughter marry your king who lives there on some island in central Mexico in the middle of a swamp. What would he even feed her? What would he dress her in? Clothes woven out of marsh plant fibers? Like, no way. He says, go away, never come back, literally. And so Huitzilihuit, the high chief of the Aztecs, has a dream, and his god tells him how to do this. And he very evocatively and sexually suggestively shoots a blow dart over the wall. The arrow is a beautiful turquoise gem, and she, the girl, is fascinated, picks it up and swallows it by accident and becomes pregnant because this gem shot by his blow dart was so loaded with life. Okay. And so then she has to marry him. But the last laugh is actually not on her and her people, because her son becomes the first Montezuma. The Montezuma that you and I grew up hearing about was actually the Montezuma II. The first one had lived a couple generations earlier. And her son, the Cuernavacan princess's son, becomes the high king of the Mexica. So in a sense, her people end up winning. So this story, it's both very beautiful and a little bit funny because of the sexual innuendo about with the blow dart and her picking up this thing from the, they even call it the beautiful shaft through which he shoots the blow dart, etc. Okay. So it's funny, but also very beautiful and poetic. And the girl ends up marrying a man she originally didn't want to marry, but it works out fine. It's a nice story, but it's also evocative of their history and of their culture. Here he is, this warrior guy trying to win the heart of a farming people, that sort of highly cultivated girl, or the girl who comes from a highly cultured people. So it's all there, both their culture and elements of their culture, but also a kind of rough understanding of their own history. I mean, obviously, that's not really how the marriage took place. I'm not nuts. But there really was a period where the Aztecs were trying to intermarry with the Cuernavacan people and having a difficult time of it. And then a later period when their alliance was very firm, but the Aztecs came out on top. So I love looking at these stories from all angles, both as stories, as fables, if you will, or even tall tales in some cases, but also as stories that are revealing of their own sense of their own history, because they are both.
Did they look towards the future at all in their stories?
They didn't refer to the end of time. There, at least in the United States, and I'm not sure if this is true in the UK, there has been an understanding that the Mayas especially, but maybe also the Aztecs, were sort of obsessed with the end of time. That turns out not to be true. They knew that there might be other worlds in the future, but they weren't going to worry about that now. But they did very much think about continuity. They thought about the future in the sense of it going on and on. They wanted their people's lives to go on and on in perpetuity. And so often the stories will begin and end with this idea that we're telling you this story so that you will remember, so that it shall not be lost. And they'll say that in many different ways, so that the grandchildren shall remember the grandparents, and the great-grandchildren shall remember the great-grandparents, and so that you shall remember the beauties of this world and all that we once knew and all that we once prayed and all that we once said. They really try to specify everything. So they were very conscious of this. And I think they always had been. That probably always had been part of the stories. I do think that we get an extra load of that because the stories are being written down in the 1500s. You know, remember, using that Latin alphabet, the Spaniards are already all around. Christianity is spreading, etc. The people who were writing this down could not have been entirely unaware of the fact that their people were, at least to some extent, their culture anyway, threatened. So I think we may get an extra dose in these stories of how important it is that you young people remember. One of the writers actually says at one point, now I'm going to begin with the story of Adam and Eve, and you may say, what does that have to do with anything? Because we are here to remember our history. But I'm telling you, it is important because you need to understand that all humankind has one single origin, that we are all cousins and brothers and sisters, etc. But so he's acknowledging that the people he expects to be reading this later are people who are interested in our history, meaning the history of other people who speak Nahuatl, etc. And he was not wrong. There was a period of a couple hundred years when these stories were underground and people didn't even know that they were there. They had been taken off to libraries, mostly in Europe. But starting a number of generations ago at this point, people in Mexico, indigenous people and non-indigenous, have been very interested in them. So in a way, their concern that their people would be forgotten proved misplaced, but not entirely so. Had the indigenous people not done such a good job of writing down these stories, they would have been lost and forgotten. It's because these stories are recoverable, thanks to their efforts, that their ancestors are now going to be remembered forever.
We've covered a few of these stories, but I wanted to ask you, are there any particular tales or myths or legends that particularly interest you, or ones that really fascinate you that you'd like to share?
One set of stories that I find very interesting, given what we now remember about the Aztecs, has to do with human sacrifice. Human sacrifice was one element of the religion of the Mesoamericans. Prisoners of war were sometimes put to death, not large numbers, but occasionally. The Aztecs brought this to a high art. The Aztecs, as their power grew, used it as a terror tactic to frighten other city-states into joining them. They would say, if you don't join us, then we're going to take dozens of your young people and sacrifice them. If you do, then that'll be fine. So politics became involved, and then it grew to be a much larger phenomenon, the one that gave birth to the legend that we have now. The Spaniards, after the conquest, did their best to spread the notion of the Aztecs as having been intrinsically and permanently people who liked to kill hundreds of other people, that they even felt that they must do this, etc. The Nahuatl language sources tell a different story. At one point, they're having a huge celebration of a 52-year cycle, which is like their century. And the king of the Aztecs, of the Mexica, says, to celebrate this marvelous and important occasion, this was in the very early 1500s, I will be generous and give 20 captives. And he says that I will make sure that the other main city-states, Texcoco and Tlacopan, that their kings also each give 20 captives. So we're talking about the death of 60 people in this ceremony. That's pretty horrible, but it doesn't match the hundreds and hundreds that we've been told by Spaniards were killed constantly. But then there are other references that are more poetic that I think help give rise to the later notion. The Mesoamericans in general counted symbolically. They had a base 20 system. So one symbol and one word was the word for 20. Another symbol, a head of hair, and a picture of a sort of a feather-like head of hair, a tzontli, was 400, 20 times 20. And then another symbol, a big sack, was for 8,400 times 20. That was a xiquipili. And in both the written sources and the pictorial sources, when you wanted to say that a lot of people had died, you'd say, you know, xiquipili, xiquipilis, you know, 8,000, 8,000, sort of. Nobody could really believe that in one battle fought with between just a few thousand people on each side at most with stone arrows, that 8,000 sets of 8,000 people had died. This was just a poetic way of talking about it. Well, there are a couple of places in the record where they talk about sacrifice this way. On a big day, maybe the celebration of the 52-year century, we are going to sacrifice, you know, xiquipilis, xiquipilis of people. And so some people have actually done the math, scholars did, and they've said, oh, that means that in one day they killed 32,000 people. Okay. I mean, it staggers the imagination. There are no caches of skulls that reflect those kinds of numbers. In the Stone Age, they didn't really have the technological capability to do that. But of course, when you understand their number system, that's their poetic way of saying a lot of people are going to die. They didn't intend for it to be taken literally. The other record was a very literal record. We've got to make this a big party, so I'm going to come up with 20. You better come up with 20 also. But coming into these records at first, I think we're not very good at judging what was a sort of poetic or exaggerated story, a kind of figurative story, and what was probably a literal record of what they had done. Different moments in time were sort of appropriate to the different projects. So I think the stories that they told about themselves regarding, you know, we're going to have, say, four sets of xiquipili, of sacrifice victims, ironically, unintentionally ended up corroborating their horrific reputation in the eyes of the world's posterity, which is not why they were doing that. They were just showing off their power. But I think it did have that effect. Now, the Spaniards were motivated to tell the stories and remember the stories in certain ways because they wanted to show that these Aztecs were horrible people who had deserved to be conquered and people were much better off under the Spaniards. But I will say that the Aztecs contributed to that themselves with these sort of wild poetic numbers that they threw around in various occasions, not just about sacrifice victims, about jewels too. He's supposed to come up with, you know, four sets of Xiquipili of turquoise. I don't think they meant it.
I think that's a really interesting point that gives us a better understanding of the Aztecs than perhaps what we've heard, perhaps what gets bandied around in popular culture, in the popular media. I wonder, is there, as a final question to you, is there anything else similar to that where that maybe can shift our understanding of the Aztecs, or perhaps something that you'd like listeners to take away?
I guess what surprised me most when I was working with these sources, and thus might be interesting to listeners, is that they had a great sense of humor. I wasn't prepared for that. I mean, when I first started, I thought that they really were in love with death. It doesn't take much work in the Nahuatl language sources to realize that they bemoaned death and that they loved life. But I still hadn't started to think of them as real people who loved a little joke. Some of the jokes don't translate very easily, and some are sexual, so perhaps not quite right for radio or for podcasts. But just for example, there was a character, Huaymac, who had been raised by the gods and then planted among them. And he sowed discord, as the fate had foreseen. He kept demanding that all sorts of that neighboring groups give him women, and they weren't big enough. So this was part of the joke, too. Their butts had to be as wide as four butts, you know, four behinds in order to satisfy him, et cetera. So eventually he's brought down, but it causes war and these two groups of people tragically break apart and it really affects their history. In any event, it comes out that the guy's name is, as I said, Huaymac. What it literally means is big gift. He's a big gift from the gods, but of course they're being sarcastic, you know, some gift. This is not a big gift, somebody whose role in their lives is to sow discord. Okay? So they call him big gift, give a little snort, you know, roll of the eyes and move on. Okay? So their jokes aren't all translatable to us, but some are. And it's really wonderful when you come across a moment like this in these, you know, aging papers in another language and a form of the language that hasn't been spoken in centuries and get the joke. And that does happen. And it helped me to begin to see them as regular people. Because in fact, some Aztecs were real jerks, I have no doubt. And some were quite wonderful, just like as is the case in all groups of people. What I guess I would want people to know about them is that in their own writings, in their talking to each other, writings for their own children and grandchildren, they come across as very much like other people do.
That was Camilla Townsend, a professor of history and the author of The Aztec Myths, A Guide to the Ancient Stories and Legends, which is published by Thames and Hudson. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.